Okay, real talk. When did paying someone back become social media?
What do you mean?
Like, say I want to see what you're doing and who you're hanging with, and you're not posting about it on your story. I can just stalk your pay app and find out what you're doing.
Oh, yeah, that's weird. You do that?
No, I don't do that. I use Apple Cash. It's built into your iPhone, easy and secure. You can send and receive money right in messages and keep it between friends, and then use that money to buy something at a store with Apple Pay.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Maybe.
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Do you love fashion? Do you love getting compliments on how well you're dressed? Are you always seeking the latest trends? Then we're talking to you. BostonProper.com is your fashion destination and the only place to go for all those nods, head turns, and new styles. No matter the day, season, or occasion, Boston Proper has what you're looking for. Sophisticated, confident clothing designed to flatter and get noticed. So visit BostonProper.com now and start creating your perfect wardrobe. Boston Proper, wear it like no one else.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, this is Annie.
And Samantha.
And welcome to Stuff I Never Told You, a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome, y'all. This is our first full episode, isn't it, of the year?
It is. It is. Oh,
and I am not off to a great start because what I originally had planned versus what we have versus what it has extended to, of course. This is my job, y'all. Anyway, but yes, we are happy to come back and do finally a full episode after being on vacay slash also being sick. Really weird start to the year. But, yeah. You know, recently we, I think we actually mentioned how we had some great conversations with people in our lives, specifically about gender roles and how traditions and expectations have really structured our internal judgment of ourselves and what we think traditions should look like. Specifically, I was talking with my partner's mother, who has some amazing stories of how she was able to overcome sexist bias in her industry and in her life overall. She is a Georgia Tech alum, so one of your people's Annies. She was one of the first in the pharmacy program and graduated. Wow. Like, she was super young, too. Like, really huge accolades to her. She did some amazing things. I remember when we were talking, my face just kind of was like, what? What? Because she was just talking about everything she was involved in. And I was like, she was really paving some ways for a lot of women in a very technical school. And she was even told by her father she would never get in because she was like, it's a school for dudes. Why, what are you doing? But she did. She graduated and she became a pharmacist, which is amazing in itself. But also one of the things that we also talked about while we were there was about Southern magazines, because holiday time. We all know that there's a lot when it comes to preparing for the holidays. We've talked about this. We've complained about this. And I have told you I would never do it. I'm over it. I haven't even started it. I'm not going to do it. but she talked about how she grew up reading Southern magazines, specifically one we will talk about later, Southern Living. And how she was really taught this is the way you were supposed to be as a woman. That everything you see in this magazine, if you want to be a perfect, successful woman in the South, this is what you follow. And my mother was very close to that. As in fact, my house had tons of Southern Living magazines. Did you have any of those?
I don't remember if we had Southern Living. My mom definitely still has a stack of magazines. I don't know how old they are, but they were very much in the same vein of like decoration ideas, recipes, advice, things like that. So I don't know if I had that specifically, but generally, yes.
Generally, something like that. And, and there are so many more. This magazine is so, so successful that it's one of the highest grossing magazines for Time Inc. So Time magazine's Time Inc. bought it not too long ago, I don't think. And the amount that they make is unbelievable, especially being that it's only literally localized to the South. So I think it was based out of Alabama. It may be still, not sure. But they circulate over, I believe, 2.8 million copies. And that was in like, that's a low number, I think, at one point in time. They were acquired by Time Magazine for $498 million in 1985. So, like, they made it. Yeah. As a magazine, they made it. They are huge. Mm-hmm. And all, some of the other publications that Time owns is Sports Illustrated, and it literally ranks up there with them for how much they make. Yeah. And if you've ever visited a waiting room in the South, you've probably seen it yourself. If you need an example, I'm sure you can find it at the grocery store. I don't know. Is it available nationally? Yeah. Or is it? Okay, I wonder.
Well, I don't know about nationally, but I've seen it in the grocery store.
If you come into the South, you have seen it. And there are so many replicates of it. Guns and Gardens, as in fact, the person, I believe the old editor of Guns and Gardens is now the new editor of Southern Living. It's been featured by so many. They are a standard. And when I tell you, when it comes to holidays, they go all out and people want this magazine and try to replicate this magazine. I have seen bloggers that have tried to replicate the perfect Southern Christmas, as they call it, and it's based off of Southern Living ideals. And so when she actually brought up that magazine, was talking about how it really affected her and her feeling like she has to keep up with the standard and really trying her best. And she was, unlike my mother, a working mom. So she was a pharmacist at the same time that she was raising her children, doing all these things and trying to be the perfect Southern woman and making sure she kept the perfect Southern home and make sure that Christmas was a Christmas wonderland. And again, I know we've talked about our own parents. You do some things with your parents, your mother, but like my mother goes all the way out. And one day I'm going to have to take pictures because the way she has like themed areas, not one theme, but themed areas with three Christmas trees. So she goes all out. And my partner's mom was talking about the fact that she was like, yeah, this year I've started to learn this was not healthy and I'm not doing it anymore. And I'm scaling back. Oh, and by the way, her scaled back, quote unquote, of Christmas decorations is still 1,000 times more than I have ever tried. Like I walked in, I was like, what? Like it looks so, it looks great. It's very pristine and pretty. And like, I was like, oh, look at all this Christmas stuff. And she's like, this is scaled back. And I was like, wow. Okay. I wonder what it used to look. I wonder if it used to be like on par with my mother with themes in every room. Who knows? Mm-hmm. And of course, just a disclaimer here, because I've been thinking about this previously. Loving Christmas and the holidays and going all out, we're not trying to tell anyone that that's a bad thing or criticizing that at all in that way. If you love it, keep doing it. I love seeing it. I literally went to one of our neighbor's house and she has so many holiday decorations. I mean, she had, I think we counted 12 trees. Like,
whoa.
Not all of them were full size, but they were decorated and they were everywhere. And she was so excited to show it off and it was beautiful. And she was so excited about talking about all of them and just like how she loves Christmas. And I'm like, that's amazing. I wish I was that person. I want to be that person. How do I become that person? So doing that makes you happy. Please know that we are happy for you. We're just pointing out that most of the time, these types of activities are typically women's responsibilities and often add more labor and work for women. And much of the past media would only deepen the idea that being a good housewife would be that they would make their home, again, like a winter wonderland, that they were obligated to do so and to not do it would be a failure as a wife and a mother. So again, some of these things are amazing and we love it and I love to see it. And if you love it, that's amazing. So please know, we are not saying not to do it. We're just saying there's also that flip side. And a lot of the times these types of magazines perpetuate this.
Mm-hmm.
But go moving on. We do, with all of that, in this conversation and in the spirit of coming back to work, we did what we do best. We went down a rabbit hole of the history of women's magazines and how they have influenced us over the years. And as an ex-millennial, and when I say ex, I mean like Generation X, because I'm still very confused by this, that went to school before the use of the internet, and we used magazines and encyclopedias as our references for actual projects. Like, we literally knew how to do the bibliography with that. I read through so many teen and 17 magazines growing up and even collected a few. Not as many as I think you might have, Annie. Did you have a lot of magazines growing up?
I mean, I don't know that I have as many as you think. I was Adventure Time.
Okay.
Was that the magazine? Disney Adventures.
I knew Adventureland, right?
I think it was.
Something with a zoo magazine,
too? It was,
too?
Like, towards kids. And then I did get Entertainment Weekly, but I usually just did it for, like, the actors I liked.
Okay.
I was thinking about this the other day. I had a really creepy shrine to Ryan Gosling, and I would take, like, cuttings from magazines and put them in this Reese's box.
Interesting.
I'm going to describe it to you in great depth later because it's really funny, but I will prevent myself from embarrassing myself. So here.
Oh, well, I have a feeling that might be on our next episode.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So
I'll share that later.
But yeah, like I, like you, had a few. I didn't get any subscriptions as a kid. Of course, my mom had, like I said, had some magazines. I did get some, like, National Geographic magazines. I'm not really sure why. I don't know who handed them down. And apparently some of them, like the older ones, are worth money. I don't know. Maybe that's an eBay thing. I don't know. and of course, like you, I didn't necessarily cut out to put them in a box, but I did do collages. So,
okay.
And you have to have, like, you know, I didn't do the ransom letter thing. That's too much. You know how you cut up random letters. But, you know, I think I did like my dream something and it was all like magazine cutouts, essentially. So we went to this. So just as a disclaimer, some of the things we're talking mainly about the history of it, of magazines and specifically women's magazines. Again, at the end of it, we are going to kind of talk about Southern Living because I did want to bring it back to it because it's mainly subscribed by women, and it was geared towards women. So we're going to talk about that. We are going to do another episode, but I think we're going to push it back because it's going to be somewhat related to the Reese's box and Ryan Gosling shrine of magazines today, including teen magazines. So just as the big arc of like, it's not a series. I'm not doing this again, Annie. I swear to God, I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm not.
This is your New Year's goal.
This is my
no
New Year's
more
goal.
12-part series. Okay.
Can I rant for a sec?
Please.
Pay apps are way too public.
What happened?
Some rando hearted a payment from 5 months ago, and I realized people can see my entire history, who I'm paying, like full names. It's super weird.
Yeah, it's weird. How are you paying your friends then?
Apple Cash. It's all in messages. You can literally send cash like a text, and it stays between friends. Random people can't see it.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Do you love fashion? Do you love getting compliments on how well you're dressed? Are you always seeking the latest trends? Then we're talking to you. BostonProper.com is your fashion destination and the only place to go for all those nods, head turns, and new styles. No matter the day, season, or occasion, Boston Proper has what you're looking for. Sophisticated, confident clothing designed to flatter and get noticed. So visit BostonProper.com now and start creating your perfect wardrobe. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.
I do want to revisit some of the magazines and subscriptions today. But again, this is mainly about the history of it. And I don't think there's any content warning necessary, but, you know, it's the history of magazines. And when it comes to history for things that are geared or consumer driven towards women, who knows?
Yeah.
So maybe it's more just
looking, condescending language, perhaps.
Yes. Lots of condescending language, a lot of consumerism, a lot of, we do talk about race even now. So, you know, there's a whole thing, I guess, but not too triggering like our past episode. So here we go.
Yes. All right. So when it comes to the overall history of magazines, it is, of course, a little bit murky. Most of the historical timeline for magazines starts at the invention of the printing press. But pamphlets and leaflets were used before that in countries like China and around the world. But going by the invention timeline, shall we say, the first magazine to ever be published was the German magazine, in English translated. I'm not going to attempt it. Edifying Monthly Discussions, which was published around 1663. I was telling Samantha I have had 4 years of German. I don't have the courage today to attempt it.
Fair.
And this was quickly followed by French published magazines titled Journal des Savants, or later known as Journal des Savants, in 1665. And in that same year, England would publish the Philosophical Transactions. And many more followed after that.
Obviously. According to a Britannica article, these journals, quote, summarize important new books, but there were as yet no literary reviews. Book advertisements by about 1650, a regular feature of the news sheets, sometimes had brief comments added, and regular catalogs began to appear, such as the English quarterly Mercurius Librarius. I feel like I'm doing a spell, or a catalog of books, which was published 1668 and 1670. But in the 17th century, the only periodicals devoted to the books were short-lived. The Weekly Memorials for the Ingenious, which was published 1682 to 83, which offered some critical notes on books, and the Universal Historical Bibliothèque, which was from January to March in 1686. The latter invited scholarly contributions and could thus be regarded as the true forerunner of the literary reviews. So this was kind of what was beginning.
Right. And according to the same Britannica article, they say the first, quote, periodical of amusement, or lighter reads, if you will, was possibly started in 1672. They write, quote, the Mercure Galant, renamed Mercure de France in 1714. It was founded by the writer Jean Donneau de Vizet and contained court news, anecdotes, and short pieces of verse, a recipe that was to prove endlessly popular and become widely imitated. And of course, this would all lead up to the beginning of magazines specifically targeted to women. As the article writes, quote, in 1693, after devoting some experimental numbers of the Athenian Mercury to, quote, the fair sex, Dunton brought out the first magazine specifically for women, the Ladies Mercury. So let's talk about how successful these experiments were.
Right. So much like today, all of the material and content that was seen at the beginning of the women's magazine era reflected what was happening during the time. As the Britannica article writes, quote, women's magazines frequently reflect the changing view of women's role in society. In the 18th century, when women were expected to participate in social and political life, those magazines aimed primarily at women were relatively robust and stimulating in content. In the 19th, when domesticity became the ideal, they were inclined to be insipid and humorless. After about 1880, magazines began to widen their horizons again. And in 1770, one of the noted first women's magazine, and I'm going to put a disclaimer here, this is listed as the first one to be published, but we know that the dabbling began much earlier, so not the actual first women's published, but the one that is most often listed and credited as the first. It was the British magazine, The Ladies Magazine. Very on the nose.
Yes. Here's a quote from the National Portrait Gallery about the magazine. The Ladies Magazine, or Entertaining Companion for the Fair Sex, London, was an early monthly periodical for women which dominated the market for most of its run. It aimed to amuse and improve, providing fiction, poetry, music, and social gossip, as well as giving more space to fashion than its predecessors. Its first issue in August 1770 included as its frontispiece a plate titled A Lady in Full Dress in August 1770, and it became the first magazine in any country to regularly issue plates showing contemporary fashions. The early engravings were uncolored until about 1790, when hand-colored ones were included.
And during the time following, there were several other publications that came around. Here's another quote from that Britannica article. Quote, later women's magazines included The Ladies' Pocket Magazine, 1824 to 1840, The Ladies' Cabinet, 1832 to 1852, The New Monthly Belle Assemblée, 1847 to 1870, and The Ladies' Treasury, 1857 to 1895, all contained verse fiction and articles of high moral tone, but low intellectual content. And the quote continues, pointing out that there were magazines that had a bit more depth, but they didn't really survive. The article reads, there were attempts to swim against the tide, such as The Female's Friend, 1846, which was one of the first periodicals to espouse women's rights, but they seldom lasted long, right? That lasted less than a year.
But what did come around soon after was the birth of the homemaker-based and practical advice magazine for women. And one of the earlier providers for this type of magazine was the English Woman's Domestic Magazine, started by Samuel Beaton with the help from his wife, Isabella Mary Beaton. You can listen to a Saver episode that I did on my other podcast all about that. And her contributions would later be published in her widely acclaimed Book of Household Management, which was a collection of Isabella's work. And here's a quote about that from that Britannica article. It was also the first women's periodical to concentrate on home management and offer practical advice to women rather than provide entertainment for the idle.
For the idol. How dare you? I guess it does stretch differently. So a little more detail from the National Portrait Gallery. It says, the English Woman's Domestic Magazine, London, published by Samuel Orchard Beaton, began as the first cheap monthly magazine for young middle-class women with a strong emphasis on practical instructions and useful knowledge such as dressmaking, but only occasional black and white engravings of French fashions. Domestic management material was written by his wife, Isabella Beaton, and collected as her Book of Household Management in 1861. In 1860, the price increased and more space was given to fashion and fiction, with colored fashion plates and large fold-out embroidery patterns and less to instructional material, as it was directed to a wealthier and more fashionable readership. Between 1862 and 1864, both shilling and sixpenny editions were issued, the first with a fashion and fiction supplement, but from January 1865, the supplement was absorbed into the magazine. The Parisian fashion plates and imported were by Jules David, first issued in L'Aventure de la Mode. Yeah, no, I did that wrong, but we're going to go on. One was included every month, and then when the magazine merged with the Milliner, Dressmaker, and Warehouseman's Gazette in 1877, it continued to issue David's plates until it ceased publication in 1881.
There were and are many of these types of magazines in the U.S., they are still with us today. Some of the first magazines include Harper's Bazaar, which was started in 1867, and the Goodies Ladies Book, which started in 1830. And the Goodies Ladies Book actually had 150 women employed to hand tint fashion plates. Previous episodes, we've mentioned them before. And in this group of magazines, also, we can include the Ladies Home Journal. And here's some information about that from Wikipedia. It was first published on February 16th, 1883, and eventually became one of the leading women's magazines of the 20th century in the United States. In 1891, it was published in Philadelphia by the Curtis Publishing Company. In 1903, it was the first American magazine to reach 1 million subscribers. And the Britannica article writes, the field of women's magazines was finally transformed, however, by Cyrus Curtis with his Ladies' Home Journal, founded 1883, edited by his wife, Louisa Knapp Curtis. This soon reached a circulation of 400,000, and under the editorship of Edward W. Bock from 1889, broke with sentimentality and piety to become a stimulating journal of real service to women.
So the history of this magazine is pretty fascinating. We have stories of editors, men, writing op-eds to oppose the women's suffrage movement, saying things like, quote, a vision of the women at home living the simple life, and having many more saying that women are enemies to themselves. So I was like, oh, that's nice.
Cool.
and then women employees, I believe this was in the 1970s, were having sit-ins to demand a woman editor. And by the way, it didn't work, but they did get their own section, which, according to Wikipedia, says, quote, they wanted the magazine to recognize a wider variety of choices for women's lives, as well as give greater attention to women's issues such as sexual discrimination and abortion. Other activists continued to protest and seem to have achieved some success. They may not have liberated the Ladies' Home Journal, but they did help change perception of how the media could portray women's lives, according to one source. And it is something to note that the first editor of this magazine was a woman, the wife, Louisa Knapp Curtis. But she was there for less than a year, and it was then taken over by the dude who really did not like the women's suffrage movement.
Mm-hmm. With the growth of women's magazines, there was what was called the Seven Sisters, which was a group of women's magazines that targeted women with husbands and children and were to assist homemakers at the time. Within this list, that we can include the original Ladies' Home Journal magazine, but also Family Circle, McCall's, Red Book, and three that are still circulating today, Better Homes and Gardens, Women's Day, and Good Housekeeping. Which, yeah, speaking of Good Housekeeping, the magazine actually started in 1885, which is more than a century ago. Here's a little bit about the magazine from an article from mylifetime.com. On May 2nd, 1885, the first issue of Good Housekeeping magazine was published. Founded by Clark W. Bryan in Holyoke, Massachusetts, the stated mission of the magazine was to produce and perpetuate perfection, or as near onto perfection as may be attained in the household.
Right. And the article continues, since early on, Good Housekeeping took its mission of producing and perpetuating perfection in the household seriously. In the late 19th century, the magazine published groundbreaking articles about food safety and advocating for consumer protection. As early as 1887, Good Housekeeping reported on topics ranging from watered-down milk to candy contamination with asbestos. And yes, they actually still have the Good Housekeeping Institute today. So this thing exists. Here's a bit of information from Good Housekeeping themselves. Quote, founded in 1900, the Good Housekeeping Institute was at first called the Good Housekeeping Experiment Station. The invention of electricity had introduced many new labor-saving home appliances, but few consumers had any real knowledge of their operation and maintenance. With the goal of studying, quote, the problems facing the homemaker and to develop up-to-date first-hand information on solving them, the staff at the GH Experiment Station tested products and housekeeping methods and published articles about their discoveries and observations. They also reprinted advice from readers who wrote them. One reader offered a cure for calluses. She used olive oil and cotton. Another reader advised about how to launder lace drapes, and another gave tips about the best way to clean a meat chopper.
Yeah. I would also offer this reminder. This is before the time of the internet, and if you listen to our episode of like Betty Crocker, this was really important. Like if you were lonely in the kitchen, you didn't know what to do, you would read something like this and be like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And you felt less alone and you had these instructions. Like you couldn't just go online and be like,
YouTube has saved many of us from some disasters.
Yes. Exactly.
And confusion.
Exactly. Yes. Okay. But beyond just observing, at one point in the early 1900s, Good Housekeeping made some huge controversies through their institute. As the institute was getting bigger and their reputation was rising with the promise of testing and giving seals of approvals for different foods and products, that bled into advertisements that the FTC would claim were exaggerated and false. And that the magazine was making, quote, misleading and deceptive guarantees. And this would lead to a lawsuit that would take 2 years to get through and even had competitors from the Seven Sister Group testifying against the magazine. The magazine did drop Tested and Approved from their seal, but it didn't really stop their growing popularity. And also, this continues to be a point of contention. And again, you can see the Savor episode we did about
that.
Maybe
we should just publish it on ours.
We should.
I think we should.
We said, what company did that? They did the diabetes, good for your heart health, and it changed the way we advertise.
Cheerios?
I think it is, but it's got to be their parent company.
Yeah.
But yes. Whatever it was that was like good
General
for your
Mills,
heart.
Right?
Yeah. Something. Yeah. But anyway.
Interesting. Keep going.
Yes. Here is another quote from Good Housekeeping. Concerned about adulteration and misbranding, home economist on staff also tested foods for purity and published, starting in 1905, a roll of honor for pure food products each month. All this testing at what was now called the Good Housekeeping Institute resulted in December 1909 with the beginning of the tested and approved list of all household products that were found to meet the Institute's standards of excellence. Good Housekeeping seal became so well known that it has become part of the lexicon with celebrities, governments, manufacturers, basically everyone using it. And yeah, as you can see, they did not include the tidbit about the lawsuit here.
Right. Mm. Found that interesting. I was like, huh, they still said the seal.
Yeah.
And you know what? they do some big claims here. And here's what's happening with the Institute today, according to their site. Quote, today, the Good Housekeeping Institute is located in the Hearst Tower in New York City and staffed by chemists, biologists, nutritionists, engineers, home economists, and culinary experts who evaluate thousands of consumer products each year, from microwave and mascaras to vacuums and towels. These reviews are highlighted in the magazine and online. When products are evaluated for the Good Housekeeping Seal and the Green Good Housekeeping Seal, which both represent Good Housekeeping's two-year limited warranty, promising a replacement or a refund up to $2,000 if a seal product becomes defective within 2 years of purchase. Certain exclusions apply. Promotional materials for the product are also reviewed. So, very consumer-like. I like it. I don't like it. Actually, I just need to go back and look and see if I've bought any of those things, even though it wasn't based on there. Well, I can't say that out loud, can I? Then I won't get a refund.
Oh, no. Well, we can't have that. And unsurprisingly, it took a while for the magazine industry to change its trajectory, and it didn't have any women editors until 1994. The first six editors out of nine were all men. Though since the first in 1994, the rest of the editors have been women. So before we move on to localized magazines, we did want to note some of the past advice from this magazine, and giving credit where credit is due, the magazine recognized their own ics and published an article titled The Good Wife's Guide to Helping Her Husband Succeed at Work. The article begins with a disclaimer saying, in our 130 years of publishing, we featured all kinds of tips, recipes, and personal stories. Some smart advice still stands the test of time. Others, well, not so much. Presented here with no further comment is a feature from the January 1956 issue of Good Housekeeping. The basic premise, a hiring manager offers his tips to a wife for helping her husband succeed at work. Enjoy.
Okay, this is also where we'll be like, yeah, this is going to make you a little angry, but also maybe make you laugh because you're like, what the hell? So here's some excerpts from that article. We employers realize how often the wrong wife can break the right man. This doesn't mean that the wife is necessarily wrong for that man, but that she is wrong for the job. On the other hand, more often than is realized, the wife is the chief factor in the husband's success in his career. In the first place, she has a very definite effect on a man's spirit. And then the article continues, if a man has a peevish, nagging wife, if she is jealous and possessive, if she is lazy or overambitious or extravagant, that man is going to be unhappy, and his unhappiness will interfere with his concentration on his job. In the case of an important executive, this lack of concentration can affect the outcome of a business conference. It may even kill a profitable deal.
Oh, dear. Well, so here is some advice that they listed off. A good wife is friendly. A good wife's primary interest is her husband, her home, and her children. And here are some specifics to that. A good wife is there when her husband needs her. She must be his sounding board. She must be able to listen patiently without giving advice. She must have the knack of commenting without interfering. Sometimes it may be necessary for her to make sacrifices for the sake of her husband and his business career. She cannot be free to do this if she is dedicated to a career of her own.
Ew, Annie. Mm. Yeah, don't have a career of your own. How dare you? This is why you're single. I'm just
like, you're right.
And then they go on and add the bad wife things. And so here it includes being a complaining woman, a dominating woman, and the wife in a rut. And y'all, we have to talk about this wife in a rut. And you might be like, well, what is that? Well, they are, quote, pathetic little creatures, is just out of her element. She is self-conscious, nervous, and awkward. Her taste in clothes is usually pretty bad. Her conversation centers on babies and how to wash the kitchen floor. 10 or 15 years ago, she may have been the pretty little girl on Maple Street. Her husband has become a man of the world, but she is still on Maple Street.
Oh, no. At least it's not Elm Street, eh?
Y'all, I mean, again, kudos to Good Housekeeping for understanding how bad this was and also being able to call themselves out on it. So hats off to them, but damn.
I feel like I connect with this wife in a rut.
I know. I'm like, wait, if all of her life she's supposed to be at being the perfect mom, what else is she going to talk about but the child and how to clean the floors?
Right.
Like, not necessarily a wife of anything, but I sometimes talk about how to clean the floors. The child part.
My clothes are bad. It's cold. I don't care.
I am definitely awkward, so how dare you, sir?
Exactly. Jeez Louise.
Yes. It's such solid advice from the 1950s.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Looking for a fabulous fashion brand that celebrates you? Then look no further than Boston Proper, where styles are designed with you in mind, so you can look and feel amazing, no matter the day, season, or occasion. At bostonproper.com, you'll find fashion that knows you best. For over 30 years, Boston Proper has been the fashion destination for confident women who want to elevate their look with unique, sophisticated clothing at affordable prices. Visit bostonproper.com today. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
But you know, we don't know this. Good housekeeping wasn't the only ones perpetuating this type of idea. And even more so, there are magazines that were published more locally, like the one that we were talking about earlier, Southern Living. And we did want to kind of talk about what they have done, what they represent a little bit of, the good and the bad, I think, in it. Eventually, I think we want to talk about the recipes from this, but we'll come back to that. If you've ever, again, as we told you earlier, if you travel through the South, and I'm not talking about Florida, but more Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, Tennessee, and those areas, and beyond, Southeast area, you have seen this magazine. The glossy picture of an idealistic, decorated to the T home. It's like Martha Stewart is the designer of this place, and it's all over the covers, just crisp and clean. And inside are articles on how-tos and the best recipes. And they even had floor plans. Like, they had some amazing floor plans to the point that it kind of started trends all over the South on what kind of homes were being built. And when it comes to the holidays, unmatched, y'all. Like, I can think of one magazine with this tree that had a very, like, Southern feel. Like, I think it says Country Christmas is what it was called. Of course, there's also a Country Living, now that I think about it, magazine. Yeah. I forgot about that one until just now. And then, like,
you're not a miniseries, you say?
I'm not going to talk about it. But it's quite interesting, these magazines, and they're very well printed and very prettily put together. And again, I believe many of the older boomer generations of women were haunted by the need to follow suit of these perfectly decorated trees and such. Again, my mom had full-on themed Christmas trees. I think one was like French country. One was like an old traditional, is what she would call it. So we would have our old school children's ornaments that we loved in one tree. So it was like she had to distinguish the two. And they were trying to be the ultimate decorators of their pristine, very pretty Southern homes. And again, we've talked about how our mothers will go all out for every season of the year to decorate. Again, my mom has like apple-themed wreaths that go for the fall, Easter-themed wreaths that go for spring. Like, it's a thing. And it goes from the front of the house. I mean, from the minute you walk up to the porch, again, the wreaths, to the guest rooms, to the living rooms, to the bathrooms. It's all there. And it's in part to these magazines.
Right. Well, this publication originally came out in 1966. It was published by the Progressive Farmer Company, which was the publisher of the Progressive Farmer magazine. And this lifestyle magazine is still one of the most subscribed to magazines. Here's a bit about them from their own site. It was for an article celebrating their 50th anniversary in 2016. Southern Living is descended from the Progressive Farmer magazine, which has roots in Raleigh and dates back to 1886. Southern Living was spun out of that magazine's lifestyle and home life section, which was popular among suburban housewives. The magazine has 2.8 million subscribers, with about 14,000 who have been subscribers for 5 decades. Wow. A large proponent of the magazine was the many different recipes featured in the magazine. In fact, they started an annual recipe book in 1979 and have been publishing them ever since. Here's what they say on their website. The 1979 edition of Southern Living Annual Recipes, which has sold well over 21 million copies since its first printing, was just the beginning. The popularity and reliability of Southern Living recipes, coupled with the steady flow of comments, questions, and suggestions from readers, led to a highly successful extension for the brand. This annual cookbook has been published every year since.
I want to say my mother would cut out these recipes.
Yeah.
And I think I have what I call like the hillbilly taco salad, which you've had before.
Yeah, it's good.
Like, it's very odd to, that I think she got from there. And I think it was in sponsorship with Rice-A-Roni, which is what I use in this, y'all.
Yes. So many recipes were like companies being like, here's how you can eat bananas. And it's a whole book of banana recipes. But my mom has that too. She has a recipe box and just has like these cutouts that are like all folded. You can't read all of it. No. She got from magazines.
I think I tried to do a homemade cake with fudge icing for my mother for that. The cake did not turn out so well. The icing was delicious though.
Well, hey, there that's you my go. Adventure show.
But you know, with the things that were happening, and this is what the appeal is, and many of the women have followed suit and still, again, still subscribe. Man, 5 decades worth for thousands of people for this magazine. And I guarantee my mom has been probably a part of that because, like I said, I had it as a child and I'm around, you know, 40 now, 40s, in my 40s now. So knowing that she's had it for that long. But the book has a lot of criticism as well, including the glaring fact that the magazine was based out of the South and at the time ignored the racism and racial violence that was happening in that time period and in that area. Some of the articles point out the fact that this magazine existed during one of the most heated times of the civil rights movement and ignored the issues around them, and that it was proof enough that this magazine and a lot of magazines like it whitewashed and overall completely refused to acknowledge the issues that were happening. A specific researcher, and I believe she was a student at the time, Summer Hill Vinson, wrote about this for her dissertation titled Whitewashing Southern Living, The Sociocultural Significance of the 1966 Magazine Launch in Birmingham, Alabama. And in her paper, she writes about the issues of how a still popular magazine hasn't really been studied when it comes to their place in history during the civil rights movement. Here's a quote from that. Historian James Cobb explained that the whitewashing of history in Southern Living occurred in the aftermath of the civil rights movement when white Southerners scrambled to find an identity that was unique but unrelated to racism. Quote, for many of them, that search seemed to begin at the very end of the civil rights era with the cleverly pleasing pages of Southern Living magazine. He argued that it was no accident that a magazine for white Southerners launched in the later years of the civil rights movement. And it goes on, that mirage hid so much pain, as American Studies professor Alan Tullos explained in the 1979 article, Azalea Death Trip. Not only are the historical rich folkways given an eye-catching or sentimental treatment, which ultimately trivializes them, but sanction is given to a way of looking at life which eliminates its unpleasant, tragic realities, its historical burdens, and its future obligations. By looking the other way, the magazine endorsed a lifestyle that romanticized reality and lets white Southerners off the hook for their role in the events taking place around them. Of course, this is just a small snippet from that article, from that dissertation. And I think it's a lot in conversation because there's also a lot of identity put into magazines like this and why mediums like this was so important. And then when we come back and talk about magazines' effects today, we will talk about the fashion industry and even the political ideas behind it. But things like this have a huge cultural impact. And again, as Annie was saying previously, this was before the internet. This is how news traveled and or what you thought other people were doing as well. They might not be you, but they're out there because you see this in this glossy, beautiful magazine saying that you should be making these recipes and ignoring everything else. There's even articles talking about how they ignored and didn't have many Black community members as featured in any of the articles, featured in any of the celebrations or any of the conversations in this magazine, which was supposed to celebrate all of the South at that time. There was a recent article about how there needs to be a reckoning for Southern Living. And I say recent, I mean the last 10 years, because they were still featuring things like plantations and showing tours about plantations and how they ignored the history behind it just to show pretty pictures of that property and making money off of that property. And again, not acknowledging what had happened there, what was going on there. I think at one point in the article that they did talk about the fact that one of the editors were like, no, we featured Black people, look. And it was like a handful, possibly a few times. And there's a lot to say in that conversation. There was also an article, which Annie, I told you about previously, and I cannot not share. I'm not going to read it necessarily, but I found it really, really funny because there's a man complaining about how Southern Living has lost its way. And I was like, wait, what's happening? And his complaint was the fact that it no longer featured recipes. It no longer featured like helpful guides or how-tos. Instead, it was now trying to sell you things, or it was trying to tell you how to be a better woman this way, like sex life, how to have a better sex life and all these things. Mm. And though he had a point, I still was like, I don't know if I want to take this from a 60-year-old white man, balding white man. Like, not just saying, like, he's not wrong.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like this is his place to say. I mean, anyone can enjoy any of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's odd to be like, you are teaching women better things. Go back to that. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. It is strange. And I think one of the things when we come back, whenever that will be, probably February, with the next part, we've talked about before on this show, I think past host Kristen and Caroline definitely talked about it, but you know, that with the internet, the magazine industry has been in flux. There has been a lot of like pressure of how they're going to survive. I personally feel like magazines are such a luxury. Like I usually only get them if there's like Star Wars on the cover, or I don't do this, but my friends, when we go to like the beach or something, we'll get magazines. But otherwise, so it's sort of an interesting space they're in. But there are, you should go listen to our old fanzine episode,
because
there are places where it's like really niche and it's growing.
Right.
So it's not that it's gone away. It's definitely a huge place for advertising, I will say.
Right.
But it's a lot of these big magazines that have been around for so long are kind of questioning, like, well, what are we now? How do we keep going? What is
right.
this?
Well, we had like, there's, and we're going to talk about this for sure when we come for an, it's not part two. I'm refusing to call it a part two for the other episode that we were going to do that's somewhat related to this about the whole virtual magazines or how it is no longer in press necessarily and is now all online and what does that look like? And then also talking about paywalls and is that a good thing?
Yeah.
But how else do they make money? Advertising,
right.
I know, but this is back and forth. And why do I find it irritating to pay for a subscription when I would have been willing to buy a magazine? Like, that's my own thing here. But again, who is affected? Who isn't affected by this? Who is being targeted? Who is being marketed to? And but also, how is it still making changes in society? Because again, a local regional magazine that like Southern Living has impacted society pretty deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with all the other magazines we talked about, like as they have, thank God, transformed or hopefully are transforming into being better messages for women and more inclusive, I would hope, and less heteronormative. But, you know, like what kind of impact they had on so many young women, older women, so many of the things that the expectations that it held. And what we bought because of it. Like at one point in time, TikTok did not exist and I was not influenced by TikTok. I was influenced by magazines telling me I needed to go get this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of those recipes would be like, hey, you want to make this aspect? Guess what? You're going to need this gelatin mold.
Right.
Here's where you can get it.
Here's this. Let me show you.
Yes, you can send in your little mail-in coupon thing and they will send it to you.
I also clip coupons out of magazines. Wow.
Yeah.
Memories.
What a world. Memories.
What a world.
Memories. Well, do watch out for our next follow-up.
Follow-up. A Valentine's Day follow-up. That's what I feel like it's going to be.
A related follow-up. And I will open the box on my Ryan Gosling shine. And you're
going
to laugh. It's very embarrassing.
I'm so excited.
But in the meantime, listeners, if you have any thoughts about any of this, if you still have any magazines or memories about magazines, fanzines, you can let us know. You can email us at stephanieatmomstuff@iheartmedia.com. You can find us on Twitter at @MomStuffPodcast or on Instagram and TikTok at @StuffMomNeverToldYou. We have a Tee Public store and we have a book that you can get wherever you get your books. Thanks as always to our super producer, Christina, our executive producer, Maya, and our contributor, Joey.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening. Stuff I Never Told You is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
Looking for a fabulous fashion brand that celebrates you? Then look no further than Boston Proper, where styles are designed with you in mind, so you can look and feel amazing, no matter the day, season, or occasion. At bostonproper.com, you'll find fashion that knows you best. For over 30 years, Boston Proper has been the fashion destination for confident women who want to elevate their look with unique, sophisticated clothing at affordable prices. Visit bostonproper.com today. Boston Proper, wear it like no one else.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.